Welcome back to the Renaissance Foundation podcast, a podcast about inspiration made by the young people at our youth charity. We support young carers, hospital patients, and at-risk pupils in London. I'm Corey, a member of staff at Renaissance Foundation, and today we are super excited to share with you one of the most inspirational people we've ever met. He's a barrister, a magistrate, activist and founder of African Prisons Project, a charity dedicated to improving the lives of prisoners in Uganda and Kenya. We were lucky enough to have an amazing discussion with Alexander McLean. He spoke completely openly with our group, sharing his stories of adversities he's faced, as well as going out of his way to give advice and address every question that we asked. We are so thankful that you took the time to talk to us, Alexander. You genuinely inspired us so much, and we're so happy that we get to share this with everyone. Thank you, Alexander. Thank you, Nisha, for hosting this session. Thank you, Rachel, for getting everyone involved, and Sat for organizing this. And most importantly, thank you to all the young people that joined the call, everyone that asked a question, and basically everyone that sat back and took in Alexander's incredible advice. Also, thank you to everyone that listens to the podcast at home and online. Please do subscribe, follow, rate it 5 stars, and make sure to share with anyone looking for inspiration. To find out more about Renaissance Foundation, head over to our website, www.renaissance-foundation.com. There you can also support us by donating. Every donation makes a massive difference to small charities like us, so we really appreciate it. We're going to jump straight into this week's episode. First, you'll hear Rachel, staff member, talking with the young people, asking them to introduce themselves. And then you'll hear from another staff member, Nisha, who's going to be the host of this week's episode. So you'll hear her talking through most of it and done an excellent job. So we hope you love it, and just share it with everyone and let us know what you think.
Hey, guys, should we all just go round sort of one by one and do our usual RF introduction to Alex? We'll start with you, Joel, if that's okay.
Hi, my name is Joel. I'm 14 and I like playing games.
Ose?
I am Ose. I'm 16 and I like anything art and cool.
I'm Ian, and I just like doing productive things, studying, wasting my time, getting my mind off stuff, just stress-free.
Sounds good.
Rafay said that he's 14 and he's passionate about playing piano. Blessed?
My name's Blessed. I'm 17 and I'm passionate about trying to make new music.
Amazing. Jal?
Hey, I'm Jal. I really like beat production and making my own music beats and stuff.
Oh, amazing.
So, thanks for that. Thanks to everyone joining the call today. I'm sorry... unfortunately, my internet's really bad, so I can't actually join it on video call. But I wanted to say a big thanks to Alexander for kindly making time today. He is one of the most inspirational people I've met. And after hearing his story, it definitely had a massive impact on me. And I thought that he would be a great role model for our young people to hear from. And then he also came in to see us at the RF Hub office last year, and really, I think, inspired all of us as well when he came in to share a bit more detail about his work. And I hope that it can give us all a bit of inspiration during this kind of challenging time, really. So, thanks so much, Alexander, for making time, and really look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks for your kind words, Sant. I'm glad to have you as my friend, and I'm glad to be with all of you this morning.
Thank you. So maybe, Alexander, we can start from the very beginning. I know you started the African Prisons Project pretty early on when you were quite young. So can we talk a bit about your school years and going on the gap year that started African Prisons Project?
Great. My dad came to the UK from Jamaica in 1960. My family didn't have very much money growing up, and for most of my childhood, my dad didn't work, and so we didn't always have tokens for our electricity meter. Sometimes we had candlelight. I had a grandma who loved me incredibly, and she gave me a real sense of strength and that I could achieve anything. I really enjoyed public speaking from when I was very small, and I was fascinated by the law, especially I started reading about the death penalty in America. My dad used to take me to the library often at weekends, and I read about people like George Stinney, who was 14 years old. Two white girls were killed in his community in the southern states of America. The sheriff said to him, if you confess to the crime, I'll buy you ice cream and you can go home. And he confessed, and they electrocuted him. And I just heard again and again these stories of mostly young black boys experiencing dreadful things at the hands of the police. And so it sparked an interest in law. The government used to pay for poor but bright children to go to fee-paying schools. So I got into one of these schools. Often, for a long time, I felt really ashamed about my poverty, and all my friends had loads of stuff and we didn't have much at all. If I could go back and speak to my younger self, I'd say, actually, the stuff that we have isn't our identity. And it's the quality of our character that makes us rich rather than the size of our house or our car. My family hadn't been to university. I really wanted to go to Oxford. I thought, if I'm going to go, I want to go to the best. So when I was 16, I started volunteering at a hospice in Clapham every Sunday. I'd had a great aunt who'd been looked after by them. And I thought hospices seemed like strange places. I just got really formed by spending time with the hospice patients and their families. And I realized I could learn loads from people who were coming to the end of their lives. I read in the newspaper about a hospice in Uganda. I wrote asking if I could go and volunteer after my GCSEs, but they said I was too young. And so I did my A-levels. Initially, I'd thought about studying history at Oxford. I love history, and I think we can learn so much from it. I got A-star in history, GCSE. I got 300 out of 300 in history, AS level. But my head of history at my school said that he wouldn't back my application to apply to Oxford. He didn't know me. So I thought, I'll go for geography instead. I love the world, and I can learn lots from it. So I thought, I'll apply for geography. I got 98.5% in geography A-level, but Oxford said I couldn't think laterally and rejected me. So then I was 18. I decided to take a year off. The hospice in Uganda said they'd have me. I learned a lot from rejection, and sometimes rejection is a gift, and sometimes we can have our eyes fixed on a certain path and it doesn't come to pass, and it can feel like failure. I think especially when you come from a family that hasn't had tremendous opportunities, and I feel at different times more heavily than others, like it's a responsibility. I really want to show up as best as I can for my parents and recognizing what they've been through. So I went off to Uganda. My parents were really worried. My mum got shingles, which is like an adult version of measles, I guess, the day I left because of stress. And I spent a month with this Ugandan hospice looking after people dying of cancer and AIDS, mostly in homes around Kampala, Uganda's capital. And they take food and medicine to them. It was fascinating. And the patients dying often lived in very modest circumstances, but they met me with such kindness and such warmth. But I didn't feel I could do much to be useful. Sometimes I was asked to say a prayer, and that was my contribution. One day we went to Malago, which is Uganda's national referral hospital. The hospice team was taking pain medicine to a patient there. We went onto this ward, and I saw this man lying on the floor by the toilet. And I said to a nurse, like, what happened to him? Why is he like that? And she said, the police found him unconscious in a market. We think he's got diabetes and he's in a diabetic coma. We don't know his name. We don't know if he's got any family, because he doesn't have any money. He doesn't get any care. He was lying on this plastic sheet in a pool of wee, and the flesh on his bottom and back was rotten down to the bone. He was decomposing while he was still alive because no one cared for him. I went back to the hospice and I spoke to the lady who founded it. She's called Anne Merriman. She's now 85. She's been working in Africa as a doctor and formerly as a nun since 1960. She said, with someone like that, even if he's dying, he can die when he's clean, when he feels loved. So I went back the next day, and with a nurse trained by the hospice, and bought a basin and soap and a towel and washed him and tried to give him something to drink to get the doctors to treat him, although he didn't have money. And for 5 days, I washed him and advocated for him. I came on the sixth day. He died the night before. He was lying dead and naked on the floor. And after a while, a porter came with a trolley with a dead woman and put the man on top of the woman and said they'd go in a mass grave with everyone else who had no one to bury them. My life changed in that moment, because I realized that there are people in our world whose lives are just to have no value. And I ended up spending 3 months on that ward caring for people who've been abandoned by their families, dying of AIDS with TB. And that's where I met prisoners. And that's where I learned about the beauty in coming together with community to look after other people, and like medical students and student nurses and the gardeners from the hospice. We got together and we started looking after those that others had rejected together. And I realized that to serve, you don't have to have money. You don't have to have qualifications. You don't have to have age or experience. You just have to have that desire to give of yourself. Yeah.
Thank you. Wow. So maybe we can talk about the next steps. How did you use that kind of newfound passion and inspiration to actually set up African Prisons Project, especially at such a young age?
I think that sometimes when we're young, we see things with a clarity that we lose as we get older. I'm 35 now, and my organization's got 50 paid staff, 300 people in prison working with us, a budget of almost 2 million. But I look back on my 18-year-old self, and I think I saw things so clearly, and I had a real strong sense of what was right and wrong, which compelled me to respond, even when everyone around me said that I was a fool for trying to make a difference. But in that hospital, I really got to know prisoners. People like Fred Wubidu, who'd been in prison for a year for stealing a goat, and the prison officer had beaten him, and he got tetanus in his wound. For several months, I and others looked after him as he gradually came to the end of his life. Or a guy called Peter Carmia, who was about 21. He had AIDS with Norwegian scabies, which makes all your skin peel off. And they wouldn't even keep him on the ward with the rest of the patients. They kept him outside. And for a week, I tried taking care of him and advocating for him before he died. And I think when we get proximate to people who are different from us, it changes us. I saw these prisoners aren't monsters. They're not like vicious, heartless people. They're just like me. They want to be cared about. They want to be heard. They want to be seen. They want love. And so I bulldozed my way into Uganda's maximum security prison to see where they came from, and ended up refurbishing the prison hospital in my gap year, believing that if prisoners were going to be sick there or die there, they should be in a place where they had dignity, but saw that actually creating a better environment motivated the doctors and nurses who were meant to work there, and the death rate of that prison dropped massively. I'd applied to Cambridge in that time, but Cambridge rejected me as well. So I ended up going to Nottingham to study law. But I ended up there, and I felt really out of place. And I'd had these vivid experiences in Uganda, and I'd really felt alive. And then I saw people who wanted to be like commercial lawyers. And I couldn't really relate to them. So I spent my university holidays in prisons in Uganda, and then in Kenya, and then in Sierra Leone. Often with my parents coming out to be with me, not because they supported this work. My dad would say, like, his chorus in my life has been, "Why can't you be a normal son?" But because they were worried about me, they wanted to come and protect me. And in my second year at university, I started the African Prisons Project when I was, 20 or 21, as a Nottingham University student society, recognizing that if we had an entity, organization, it could help us to raise funds, it could help us to mobilize support. We started out by establishing prison libraries and clinics, thinking that health and education are fundamental. And in my second year, I became a magistrate. Magistrates are the lowest level of the judiciary here. We can send people to prison for up to a year. We deal with about 95% of criminal cases. As a magistrate, you have to go to visit the prison you'll send people to. And so I went to Nottingham Prison, and the prison officer locked me up. He couldn't believe I was a magistrate. He thought I was a prisoner instead. And I don't often, possibly never, have I seen a young brown man magistrate. But I saw law in practice. I seen that in the books, law was quite dry. But in real life, I saw, wow, like, it vividly affects all of our lives. And I remember one of the first people I saw in court was I think she was about 18, and she was a prostitute, and she had a drug addiction, and she was in court for having some tablets on her. And her lawyer said how she was incontinent. She couldn't control her bladder. You looked at her and you could see she was suffering. Another magistrate said, she's not a first-time offender. She's been doing this kind of thing for some time. How can we punish her in a harsher way to recognize it? I thought, actually, is the function of justice systems just to punish, or is there a scope for mercy as well and for restoration? So I continued with my legal studies. I did my undergraduate in law. I did my master's with the University of London from Uganda. After graduating, I went to live in Uganda. I studied for the bar, traveling backwards and forwards between Uganda and the UK. I guess my heart was formed. And I think that sometimes when we're young, people look at us and we're trying to make a difference. They say, you're young, you'll grow out of it, or you'll see better, or like, you'll settle down and you'll you'll really start to get serious about what matters. And people will discourage us in so many different ways. But I saw things which I couldn't unsee. And I came close to people in whom I saw I had a shared humanity, and I realized I couldn't just leave this work behind. And so Yeah, I've been working in prisons in Africa since 2004, since I was 18, all my adult life. I've now spent time in about 130 prisons in 17 or so countries. And now I've got a community which I'm part of. And it's been a real gift. And I get to sleep, go to bed at the end of the day and know that my day's counted for something. Not to say that I've not made big mistakes, not to say that many, many, many things haven't gone to plan, not to say that it's easy for me to dream, but not always so easy to execute them. But I count myself a fortunate man. And one of the things that stayed with me from being at the hospice when I was 16 is that life is precious and none of us is owed anything. And I want, whenever I come to the end of my life, to look back on it and to feel that I've really lived, and not lived just to get more stuff. There's a part of me that loves to have more things and to have more status and more recognition. But actually, I think I feel most truly alive when I give that away. And when I'm in relationships with people who love me and who I love, and when I'm doing work that feels really meaningful.
Yeah, that was really inspiring. I can literally see the passion on your face. So, and you did kind of touch on this, but obviously working for prison reformation and basic human rights doesn't come without its hurdles. And so I wondered what kind of keeps you motivated? What keeps, how do you say, persistent in trying to achieve all these goals?
You know, I'm not certain. I think that sometimes if everything hasn't been totally handed to you on a plate, and I'm not saying that I've received tremendous kindness and generosity in my life, but things haven't always been totally straightforward. In one of my interviews for pupillage as a barrister, one of the barristers interviewing me said, "So do you come from a broken home? And how come you didn't join a gang or become a drug dealer?" And sometimes, you know, we all show up in different situations, but sometimes people are really quick to jump to a conclusion about you. But I think that sometimes when everything doesn't go totally straightforward, it can build some resilience. It can build some reserve within you, which keeps you keeping on. It's something I think Sat and I have in common, that we know how to keep on going because somehow it feels like life's equipped us for it. Perhaps because I look back on my parents, especially what my dad's been through, I think actually my life's been a bed of roses compared to most of the things he's gone through. I get strength from the people I share my life with, from proximity. During this time of lockdown, every Monday and Wednesday and Thursday, I meet with people in prisons in Kenya over Zoom, and we have prayer together or worship together. And actually, I'm with people on death row and with prison officers, and some judges have started joining us. I think although I have challenges in my life, other people also have challenges and they persevere. So I look at other people's example and it makes me strong. And through sharing my life with others, and I think sometimes it can be easier to move by ourselves or to feel like we've got a burden that we have to bear that's our own. But when we open up to others and we build friendships with openness and vulnerability, like Sat and I have, it makes us strong. And sometimes one of you is struggling and then the other gives a hand up and then the roles reverse. And so I think friendship makes my life rich. And I'm a Christian. I look at Jesus' example and he loved those that the world rejected. And he said that in those on the margins of society or those whose like brokenness is on the surface, some of our brokenness I think is more hidden, there's gifts and talents and potential and strength. And actually I learned so much from my friends who are in prison or on death row or prison officers who earn £100 a month. And so I think that we're invited into relationship all the time. And I think that one of the things about living in London in this day and age is that we can feel that somehow it's a rat race or it's a dog eat dog world. And like, in order to get ahead, we have to tread on others. And I think that when I question, well, what does it mean to get ahead? And is it just about having more stuff? As I look at the advertising around me and it says that the things I have will make me happy. And if I have the latest iPhone, I'll feel joy. I know it's a lie because I get more and more stuff. And I see that it doesn't fulfill those things. And I think that for me, I move forward and my life is joyful when I share it with others, when I try and slow down and live at a pace where I'm present in what's going on within me. I'm present to what's going on in the person in front of me. I'm not consumed with the past or with the future, but I'm showing up now. My wife and I have had 5 miscarriages, and we lost twins last year, just around the time that Sat and I met. And in that process, we really felt totally broken, like we had nothing to offer anyone. And I'm used to having quite a lot to offer different people in my family, in my work, in my friendships. And we had their funeral, and Rose Hudson Wilkin, who became Britain's first black woman bishop, took their funeral. I remember that day, and I thought, actually, I've got nothing to offer anyone because my heart's just broken. And then people loved me and they made me strong. And Rose and the undertaker, a guy called Tony and a guy called SB from my church who led worship, they really loved my wife and me when it felt that we had nothing. So I think that I'm trying to learn how to slow my life down so I'm present to others around me and to the gift they have to offer me and the gift that I have to offer them, and not just always to be dreaming of the future and like to let my pride or my hubris let me just have these grand dreams for myself, my work, but to find joy right here, right now with you.
Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that really powerful story. I just want to make sure we also open it up to all the young people. I think maybe there's one from Ayan in the chat already. Ayan, do you want to ask yourself?
Hello there. So it seems that you've met many people that have done wrong things, and you're here for them, and you're sort of helping them to reform, and you've shown so much kindness with them, so much mercy, unlike other people who have just let them rot in their prisons. So how about those who do much more horrible things? Do they deserve the same forgiveness as those who steal or those who assault? Do they deserve the same thing? And please do note that they didn't give any mercy before they began the crime. I'm sorry for speaking in broken English. It's because I'm nervous.
I know you spoke very clearly, and thank you for asking a question and for being the first one to ask. That takes courage. I guess my starting point is that I'm not good. I'm not someone who's pure and faultless, so I can just make judgments on others. Although I spend my time as a magistrate making decisions about others. But I come into it knowing that I too make mistakes, that I too need mercy and forgiveness, knowing that a lot of the way that I've lived my life is because of opportunities that I've had, and wanting to live life with a posture of being quick to love and slow to judge others, and recognizing that sometimes it's only when you walk in others' shoes that you can understand their circumstances. I believe that we need to have a justice system. There's been a lot of talk recently about all cops are bastards. I've been learning about it over the last week. I think that police are fundamental to our society, and definitely there'll be some police officers in any society who are cruel or merciless, but there are the others who are compassionate and kind and committed to doing the best they can. I think justice system should be about ensuring that anyone who's accused of an offence has a chance to tell their side of the story. It doesn't always happen. And whether it's in the UK or in Africa, we're seeing legal aid is being cut back, more and more people coming to court without anyone to speak on their behalf. I think everyone should have their voice heard. And I think that for those who are guilty of offences, the punishment should have a focus on equipping the person to contribute to society again. Almost everyone who's in prison around the world now will one day be released from prison. In prison, it's just about treating them as harshly as possible, about every day reminding them of the mistake they've done and making it weigh on them heavily. When that person gets out of prison, they're not just going to easily slot back into life. They'll often feel further removed from society, and I think create a further danger. So for me, when it comes to prison, I understand the purpose of it being to remove people from society as a punishment and to keep society safe. But what happens inside prison should be all about equipping people for life after release. I think that through proximity, and I guess that I've met hundreds, if not thousands, of people who've killed others, people who raped others, people who've badly hurt others. I've realized that behind every statistic, there's a person with a name, in a story. And I guess when I hear about circumstances of offending, some are really abhorrent, and it can be difficult for me to hear or see the humanity in the person who's committed it. But I guess I ask myself, well, what would it, if I was in exactly that circumstance, could I have done the same? And so I really try and be slow to judge. And I share my life with people who've killed, and some women whose husbands have beaten them for years and years and years, or the husband has AIDS and he wants to rape the wife, and then she fights back and she kills him. She's killed. It's true, she has. But in that circumstance, would I have done differently? Am I the one to judge that her response was wrong? We work in countries where people are in prison for serious offences which they've committed. But also I work with women in prison because their child became sick. They take them to the hospital. There's no medication there. The child dies. Then they take the mum to prison with the rest of her children for child neglect. Or people who are in prison for being idle or for being gay. Or because they've attempted suicide because they're in the midst of a mental health crisis. They try to kill themselves and then they become a prisoner. So my stance is, I want to be slow to jump to conclusions about others. I want to try and be quick to listen and slow to speak. But I believe that everyone deserves second chances. I think it's right to have consequences when we make mistakes, but I think that punishment should be geared towards rehabilitation and restoration of the one who's done wrong. And I think fundamentally, and I guess part of it is as a Christian, I believe each person is created in God's image and God knows each person. And so I think even when someone's made a tremendous mistake, there's an opportunity for them to make it right. I think that those who've done tremendous bad with their lives can also do great good. I don't think it's for me to condemn someone as being worthless or being wicked or having no contribution to make to society, though I do think it's right that we face consequences when we break the law.
Thank you. I think that also just shows how complicated it is to be a judge or a magistrate and make those decisions. It's not an easy black and white choice. Do any of the other young people have any questions? Otherwise, I can continue. Okay, I'm going to take that as a no. But if you do, just put it in the chat or just feel free to interrupt me at any point. So I think we've obviously been seeing a lot of, with recent events in the news and everything, how can we be activists? How can we start making change from our homes within our communities?
I suspect, from what I know about Renaissance Foundation, that many of you already are activists. For me, activists mean someone who's active, someone who doesn't just sit by and watch when we see an opportunity to show love, an opportunity to speak up, an opportunity to serve. It means we... You know, it's much easier, I think, in life to be on the sidelines, and often to be on the sidelines criticizing the one who's in the ring doing. Someone shared a quote with me years ago, which I really liked, which says, "I prefer the way I'm doing things than the way you're not doing things." So my sense is that amongst this community, there's a lot of people who are stepping out again and again and again in favor of others. It's been fascinating hearing the conversations over the last days since George Floyd's death about how we serve, how we shape our society, how we make voices heard, how we create allyship. I think the proximity changes us. I think that getting close to people whose lives and circumstances and experiences are different from mine and sharing with them, not going in and trying to educate them or to change anything, but going in as peers. And listening is powerful. I love eating meals with people who are different from me, having Sunday lunches in prison with prisoners and prison officers and lawyers and judges, and saying, let's just come together as brothers and sisters and share and learn together. So I think proximity changes us. I think that persevering with relationships changes us. I think about the fact I've been working in prisons for 14 years. I've never spent one night in one. So I'm learning a little bit about prisons and what it's like to be there, but I can't speak with the voice of a prisoner. And the lessons that I'm learning are coming slowly. So I think it takes time. I think in primary school, we had a teacher called Mrs. Dent who spoke about the power of having the courage of our convictions. I think that sometimes we're told that our opinion is not valid. We don't have the right to have an opinion. Or we get used to not speaking our mind because we want to keep others on board, or we're worried about how others will perceive us. I think that each of us is invited, whether we're young or old or brown or black or white or anything in between, or rich or poor, anything. We're each invited to get to know ourselves, and then to speak with that, from that understanding of ourselves, and to trust that others will receive it, and to have the courage of our convictions. And I find that during the moments in life when I'm in tune with what's going on within me, and I speak it out, I speak out my truth, people that I didn't expect to respond can respond in powerful ways. I can build bridges with my life in ways that I hadn't anticipated. I think for me, it's also being quick to recognize I don't have all the solutions to any problem. It's not for me just to educate others or to shame others or guilt them. And I don't think that making others feel bad about them changes much at all. For me, I'm wondering what it looks like with my life to try and point people towards a brighter future or something beautiful, and to attract them on that journey with me, rather than to criticize or hector to make them move. I think thinking about how we can build alliances and how we can work through relationship, that can really make us strong. And many feelings have been stirred in me over the last days since George Floyd's death, not least because people say, hey, you're brown, what's your opinion about this? And when I first saw the images of him being killed by the policeman, it didn't strike me as so unusual, because I've seen so many other images like this in the past weeks and months and all my life. But I think it's when people are asking us to speak into a situation, and like our church asked a number of us as brown people, and there aren't that many, it's mostly white church, to be involved in a conversation yesterday about it. It's being willing to speak out and to share our experience. For me, it can feel quite vulnerable to do that, because you're putting yourself out there and people can like say, oh, this guy's just like a angry brown guy, he's got a chip on his shoulder, and why wasn't he speaking out when other like about black on black crime, or why isn't he trying to talk into issues of black dads showing up for their children more, or like black people getting better education? And I think, gosh, sorry I spoke, because actually you just want to rip me down. So for each of us here, I think we're being invited to speak out our truth with courage. And to say, actually, some people will hear me and some people won't. Is it allowed to swear on this podcast? It's just one swear word. But for a long time, I worked with a chap called Zuri who ran the... he was a senior officer in the Israel Prison Service. He's a great friend, and he's got a strong character. But one day I said to him, but Zuri, what do you think other people will think if we do this? He said, I don't give a shit what other people think. I think, what does it look like to live life with that conviction? Because actually it can be, for me, it can be overwhelming to think, is someone going to be upset if I say this? Are they going to be offended if I do that? Am I going to tread on toes? Am I going to get it wrong? Am I going to look back with regret and say, actually, I have to speak my truth as it is today. Maybe next week I'll question it. Maybe next month I'll say I was wrong. My opinions change. But I think we're invited in each conversation, in each interaction, to show up as we are, not to hold back. And for me, sometimes it's been easy for me to hold back and then to regret it.
Thank you. I think there's definitely loads of really small stepping stones that we can take away from that and implement into our own lives. I'm just going to ask again if anyone else has any other questions. And I'm going to take that as a no. So, what is a piece of advice that you would give your younger self, and also maybe our young people?
I think that if I look back to myself as a teenager especially, I think I was so concerned by what others thought, and I'd let others' judgments of me really strongly shape how I see myself. And I'm not saying that it doesn't still. And I was speaking with Sat just now about my relationship with my dad, and he was saying to me a couple of weeks ago, like, when are you going to settle down and just take some responsibilities for yourself? I think, my gosh, like, I've got two children, a third on the way. I've been married for almost 10 years. I lead this organization, which is doing okay. I feel like my life has a bit of fruit, but he doesn't see it. But I wish that, I think that even how, regardless of how young we are, and the quality of our character should be what defines our relationships, and we should accept ourselves. And I think I felt shame for a long time because I didn't have very much money, and I thought that somehow that put me on the back foot. And I've done work around my relationship with money, which means that now with the work I do, some of my friends are billionaires and have hundreds of millions. And I think fundamentally we're the same. And fundamentally, I think we want to belong. We want our lives to count for something and to have some value. I think I'd have spoken to myself about my friends. And I think that sometimes I felt a strong sense of needing to conform. Now I want to surround myself with people who I look at how they live their life. And I think, I want to be like you. I look at their values and I think, yeah, I want some of what you've got, and invite them into my life. Because I think that we become like the people we spend our time with. And someone said, like, we're a product of the five people that we spend the most time with. And so now I think about my relationships, and some of my closest friends live in different countries, but I really want to be with people who, like, love in a way that challenges me to love, who have conviction in a way that helps me to grow in conviction, who have compassion in a way that challenges me to grow in compassion. And I think that I'd also tell myself, live in the present. Don't let the future define you so much. And I think that at school, it was like thinking, well, like, where am I going to go to university? And then what's my career going to be? And how am I going to get ahead? And say, where's the gift in today? And I think that this moment is a time that's filled with much uncertainty. Many young people are asking, like, what does the future look like? What does work look like for me? How will I take care of myself? Are my dreams legitimate? So many people told me, like, basically, it's not legitimate to dream, or you can't achieve this, or you're crazy, or when are you going to, like, become sensible? So many people tried to, I guess, to push me back. So many others also pushed me forward. I'm not saying it with bitterness or resentment, but it... see the opportunity that today brings, and trust that that will equip you for tomorrow. And I love this. It's a poem, and it was found on the body of a lady called Sister Odette Prévost. She was a nun in Algeria in the late 1990s, and it was a time when a lot of nuns and monks or religious people were being killed there. It was a time when there was a lot of fear, as I see a lot of fear now, and she was murdered, and on her body when she was murdered, this poem was found, and it really speaks to me. I read it often because it speaks to how I want to live my life. It says, "Live today's day. God gives it to you. It belongs to you. Live it in God. Tomorrow's day belongs to God. It doesn't belong to you. Do not impose today's worry upon tomorrow. Tomorrow belongs to God. Hand it over to Him. The present moment is a frail footbridge. If you wear it down with yesterday's regrets, tomorrow's anxiety, the footbridge gives way and you lose your footing. The past, God forgives it. The future, God gives it. Live today's day in communion with Him." So I think that's what we're all being invited to do, to live today's day, to be alive to the opportunities today, to live in the midst of lockdown and in the midst of the challenges that we face, to see the beauty around us, to see the things that we have to be thankful for, the people who love us, and to find joy there.
Thank you. Well, this has easily been, I think, our most inspirational podcast. I'm just radiating with inspiration. I'm going to ask the final question, and then I'm going to put the pressure on the young people to take over, although I think we are running out of time anyway. So maybe if you guys just want to think of one really quick question. I just wanted to know...
jump in. The questions can be silly, they can be small, they can be big. Anything is legitimate, anything at all that you want to bring to the table. For me, often I'd be in this situation, and then I'd bite my tongue, and then afterwards I think, why didn't I ask that? So please, just everything's up for grabs. Sorry to interrupt.
No. Yeah, definitely. But whilst you're thinking, oh, we've got one from Ayan. Ayan, do you want to switch on your mic and ask?
So how are you so calm, like all the time? You look like the type of person who would always be calm no matter what situation. Like if there is a shooter in the school, you'd just be like, hang on, I forgive you. Now go back home and stop doing that. You wouldn't just run away or be like, everyone out the building. You just go straight to his face and say, it's okay. Stop being angry. And yeah, how do you keep calm? Like, I can't bear my sister. She keeps snatching my PS4 away and my stuff. And I'm like, Mom, get over here and drag her away. So how do you keep your cool? Please tell me.
Thank you, Ayan, for that question. I know how irritating siblings can be. As I'm speaking to you, I can hear my daughter screaming at my son downstairs, and they constantly lose their cool. There's a quote from Shakespeare which speaks to this. Let me just give me 1 minute to find it. I don't want to misquote him. I think it's from Hamlet, and it says, "There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." And I've realized that, you know, in life, there are highs and lows. There are times when it feels like everything is going incredibly. For me, it can be like getting a big donation to support our work, or being in the media. And there are times when things are low. My dad's living with heart failure. It's really difficult accompanying him as he's coming towards the end of his life and seeing how it weighs on him, or losing our babies, or my wife's pregnant at the moment. And like it's just been really, really scary. And every day for months, we're just scared of our baby dying. And so I realized that the circumstance I'm in can consume me. And the times when I got like the big donations, I'm like, yes, I can do it. I'm an incredible fundraiser. And the time when we lost our babies last year, I thought, well, maybe it's just impossible for us to have a healthy child again. And I think that living with a little degree of detachment, which is saying this is happening to me today, but tomorrow will be different, whether it's the best or the worst. So it's understanding, I guess, how do I have a degree of control over what's going on within me? Because, you know, for me, when I get successful, I can become so proud, and I'm thinking, my head becomes inflated very easily. And when things go wrong, I can really feel tremendous pain. And I think that it's legitimate to have strong feelings, and it's okay to be proud of the things we've achieved and to feel pain. But I want to, I guess, to live slowly. I'm trying to learn how to think slowly so that I don't get taken off course. If someone just heaps a praise on me, all I hear is good things, but maybe underneath the surface, they've got a different agenda. Or when someone criticizes me, I can think, my gosh, it's true. I'm rubbish at this and I can never change. It's a lie. I can change. And so it's recognizing I'm a work in progress. I'm neither good nor bad. There are parts of me which are working well, and there are other parts which aren't so good. And so I guess I'm trying to live with a mind that's a little bit quieter. So every little thing that happens to me in my day doesn't take me off track, but I want to live steadily, because I don't know what life's going to throw at me. I think some incredible things are going to happen, but I know my heart's going to be broken again as well. And so I want to live lightly enough so that whatever comes, I can try and be alive in the midst of it. Yeah, exactly. As you say, living a moment at a time.
Thank you. And if anyone wants to ask a question, this is, we're coming up to the final moment, so don't be shy. Anything at all?
I've got a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So with me, if I want to be motivated, there's like a type of music I listen to. So is there like a type of music that you listen to like to get yourself motivated, or for you to get inspired to do something?
Thank you for that question. I think music's a powerful motivator for me, and it's powerful as a means of connecting me with others. At the moment, I feel most motivated when on Mondays and Wednesday and Thursday mornings I hear the ladies in the women's prison in Nairobi singing and thinking about the circumstances they're in and what their life looks like now, but they sing with such beauty. It really makes me feel strong. I find that I love choirs and the unity in choirs. I've got a wide taste in music, and I love to dance, and I wish I danced more. I think that when I started this work, it was dancing. Like, I'd be in prison in the day and in nightclubs at night, and dancing just brought me to life and it allowed me to express myself in a new way. And I can't dance well, but I love doing it. And sometimes my wife and children, I will just dance in our kitchen, and there's a lot of joy in it. And I want to live life with a lot of laughter, even though I'm dealing with serious issues. I listen to all sorts of worship music. There's a community in the south of France called Teze, and they bring about 100,000 young people every year go to spend a week at Teze community from all over Europe and around the world. Some Christians, some atheists, some Muslims, all different backgrounds, but they've got a very prayerful, contemplative kind of music, which involves like singing simple choruses. And there's one, it's in Italian, but in English it said, "The Lord restores you. God doesn't run from you. He comes to meet you." And for me, it's powerful because it makes me think, actually, regardless of my circumstances, regardless of what I'm struggling with, regardless of how I feel, God can meet me just where I am. There's a church in America called Bethel, which produces worship music. Some of that I like. There's one song called Take Courage, which I listen to all the time. And we had it at our baby's funeral last year. And I want to live life with courage. And it's not always easy to be brave. As an organization, our values are bravery and humility and solidarity. And I want to be brave. And brave doesn't mean like always just feeling like I'm going to go out as a rock star and I'm going to overcome everything all the time. But I think bravery is making a choice that even regardless of what our current circumstances are, we're going to try and show up fully. We're going to try and be open to others. We're going to try and not just take the easiest way out, but we're going to try and live in accordance to our values or our dreams, not to let go of the things that matter most to us. And so music, which encourages me to be brave, is powerful. And also, as a Christian, music which says, I'm not the sum of my achievements. I love achieving. I love being recognized as an achiever. But actually, that's not my identity. For me, it's understanding I'm loved just as I am. And very often I get into circumstances, I'm like, well, I can make this better. And I can bring something to the table here. But it's saying, actually, I don't need to always be thinking, what can I do? How can I improve things? How can I change things? I also need to learn to rest in the fact that I'm enough, just as I am, and not to let my achievements or my organization become my identity, and to know that I'm loved for being me.
I have to say, once you said Bethel music, I actually started jumping. I love Bethel music so much.
Yeah, there's...
Thanks for that answer.
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear that we have it in common. What are some of your favorite songs?
Fuck, look, honestly, there's so many. I'm pretty sure it's almost every single one. I can't even think of one right now.
Yeah, I'm with you. There are a lot that I enjoy. But I think it's good to remind ourselves of basic truths about ourselves. For me, it's that I'm loved regardless of what I do, that I'm not alone regardless of how difficult my circumstances feel, that I'm seen, that I'm known, that I belong. And you know, there's many things and people in life that can throw us off track a bit. And I think these reminding myself of those truths, they're my truths, and can help me to recenter myself and to have a little bit of that calmness, which Ayan spoke about.
Thank you so much. I think we're running out of time, so we'll end it here. But thank you so much, Alexander, for being open and honest with us. It was so inspiring. Can we all take ourselves off mute and give a big round of applause?
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Amazing. So, yeah. Thanks. I think because Corey and I have met you before, we were like so excited this morning, weren't we? I think I messaged Corey and he's like, really excited for this session because we just know how inspirational you are as a person. And it must be killing you not having that presence with people, I imagine. So yeah, we hope that we've been able to somehow kind of give you that today with us. And I hope that you can feel our energy and reaching out to you because we really appreciate all your support and all your kind words and how heartfelt it was.
Yeah, I can feel it. It's good to see you both again. I think it's incredible what can be done online, and I do feel close to you. And my invitation to everyone here and anyone that you know, if you're interested in the law Or if there's anything that I've shared that you want to have a conversation with me about, or if there's any way that I can serve you, I'd be glad to do so, because so many people, I spoke a bit about challenges, and it's true, there are for all of us, but there have also been so many people who stepped up and journeyed with me and encouraged me. So if you're interested in the law, want to have conversations around it, or in aspects of building organization, or like, think about our relationship with money. I don't have many solutions, but I've tried things. I failed in many areas, but it's a joy for me to go on the journey with people and to see young people living with boldness and with courage. And if there's anything I can do that can support you in that, then it would be my pleasure. Yeah, I'm available to you if there's anything I can do that's of value.
Oh, thank you so much. No, that's amazing. I'm sure that I'll follow up with everyone. And I think that we've got a lot of people at RF that are interested in so many different things. Some of them a little bit more certain, some a little bit unsure, but I think they'll definitely, be interested in following up with you. And hopefully we can meet again soon and actually plan something a little bit more interactive as well. Because I know that the last time we met you, we did sort of speak about a few plans to do something. But who knew this would be the next time that we'd speak to you?
It's good speaking, though. My wife's a doctor. Yes. She's interested in medicine, and she can help on that front. We'd be glad to. But I'm glad to be part of your community. Thank you for inviting me in. And I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Alexander. We really, really appreciate it. You were so engaging, inspiring, and the fact that you spoke so openly with us with so many adversities that you've overcome, I think really helps to give the power to the advice you gave us and to help us deal with different situations we're all going to face or have faced. So we really, really appreciate this, Alexander. We definitely want to see you in action in court. We'd like to come and visit some of the courts that you're a magistrate at, and we just can't say thank you enough. I just want to keep this outro very short because I don't want to take away from the impact of the discussion, but I just want to let everyone who's listening at home know to please rate us 5 stars, subscribe, share it with anyone who needs inspiration or is looking for inspiration. And just if you are looking to donate, you can head over to our website, and we'd really appreciate that donation as well, because it really helps us small charities. And we're going to carry on making this podcast, getting inspiration content out there. So all we need you to do at home is listen and share what you like. So thank you to everyone involved. Thank you again to all the young people that took part in the discussion. We know that you really enjoyed it. And let's try and get you back, Alexander, because that wasn't long enough. We need a lot more time with you. So I just want to say thank you. We really enjoyed this.